Well, because we're late in starting, I won't give my half-hour introduction to her. But I just want to say it's a great personal honor for me to introduce Irv today. We first met, actually, in around 1977 when we were both members of... Could be my voice. Is this better? Irv and I first met in 1977 when we were both on the immunobiology study section of the NIH. And I recognized at that point that this is a brilliant guy who could think about science and other things in ways that in innovative, brilliant ways that most other people, and I think you'll get a sense of that in this lecture of and other three lectures. I just want to point out that the origins of where he comes from and how he got to where what he did and where he is now is actually interesting. It's, I guess, interesting for every person, but Irv was born in Great Falls, Montana, and grew up there, and actually got his Bachelor of Science degree from the Montana State University. Although I understand he spent a couple of years also at Dartmouth, prior to that, and went to Montana to learn the pre-medical courses. Anyway, from there, he went to Stanford University. And he got, not by luck, I'm sure, got involved with two major people early on in his career, which I think he may disagree with me, influenced him enormously in the directions he eventually went. One was a clinician radiologist who was also a leukemia cell biologist and was interested in the development and differentiation of the leukemic cells. And he was at Stanford, and he was also influenced. He spent less than a year in Oxford with this guy, Gowans, who I think was responsible for telling us that lymphocytes were important in the immune system and actually analyzed the functional properties of lymphoid populations. And some of the experiments that came out of that lab involved infusion of lymphocytes into other cells and looking at functional activities. Well, make a long story short, eventually Irv was to make major steps forward in our understanding both of leukemogenesis, and as you'll hear, in fact, recently discovering stem cells within the tumor itself that gives rise to the leukemia, and also from Gowan's work, learned about the differentiative history of lymphocytes. Then he switched gear a little bit, I guess, and started to learn about immunologists, and in particular, immunology, and in particular about tools that were being used by immunologists, including using cell surface molecules to look at differentiative states of all sorts of cells, including T cells. And he went from there back to his initial questions of the origin of these cells, and ultimately he'll relate this better than I can, but ultimately came up with the idea that there were cells that had two properties inherent in the same cell. One is that they were self-renewing, and the other was that they could differentiate into more mature cells. And those are the major properties that he eventually defined were properties of stem cells. Now, there are many basic scientists who never get a chance to do the next thing that he was able to do, and that is apply it for use, all this science, to a use in medicine. And his work now is the foremost work involved in enabling physicians to think about and actually do hematopoietic cell transplantation in patients with cancer, in patients with immunodeficiency diseases, and other types of patients that I'll tell you about. And he's been recognized for all these accomplishments in some of the usual ways, like being elected to the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy, being the president of the American Association of Immunologists, recognized by the Irvington Institute as the outstanding immunologist of the year, and so forth and so on. With that in mind, I really look forward to this next week, and I'm sure we'll be educated by this, and he'll bring it to a state where we could ask the question I first asked when I was called to get involved in this, and that is, why is the Department of Religion the first to really give at Columbia, invite Irv down to give a series of lectures? But on the side of Columbia, I think it was 2 years ago, he was given an honorary degree from the university. So he's one of us in terms of the faculty. It's with great pleasure.
Thanks, Len. A lot of room down front. Now, the four stories I'm going to tell over the next 2 weeks have to do with the discovery of stem cells, their use. And the first thing you need to know about stem cells, well, the first thing the audience has to tell me, raise your hands if you know what the word cell means. Raise your hands if you don't know. Thank you. I know that. I knew it would be you. The last time it was an astrophysicist. Okay, so we know what cells are. Now, you probably don't know, but lots of cells die in your body. They get old, or they get exposed to the elements, and they die. You need to have a way of replacing the cells in any tissue. You got one of those pointers? Harvey usually carries one. Anyway, I'll keep going. The question is, how do you regenerate brain cells, skin cells, blood cells, and so on? In 1961, the germ of an idea came from an experiment by two people in Toronto. And I have to back up and say the whole field actually got started from a military and political and social event. That was the bombing of civilian populations in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as you know, in 1945. The bomb didn't just kill people by the blast. The bomb killed people by the radiation. Those people who died within a day died of massive high-dose radiation, probably to the central nervous system. You can reproduce it in animals. Those that died 5 days had lost the cells, the stem cells, that regenerate the whole gastrointestinal tract. 5 days after the radiation, there's no cells left, so the fluids of the body go out through the GI tract. You die of an irreparable diarrhea. Those that died at the lowest dose of radiation that killed died because they lost their blood-forming system. So they didn't have the kinds of cells that could fight off the bacteria that live in our bodies and can enter our bodies every day. If somebody in that sad state of having lost the blood-forming system bumps into something, they can't heal it by clotting the blood. So the radiation syndrome described in 1945 with people was then retested in animal models. Very rapidly it was shown that the lowest dose that kills, in fact, kills by wiping out the blood-forming system. It was then showed that you could put a lead shield in front of any bone of an adult mouse or an adult dog, and that would save enough cells that the whole blood-forming system would regenerate itself. Now, we should have learned a lot from that experiment. But, you know, scientists just accept the facts and keep moving on. What we should have learned, and what I'll show you formally by some kinds of experiments, is that the cells of the blood-forming system that are in one little tiny piece of the bone can move through the body and do so naturally to reseed the places, which are called niches, places, for stem cells, and regenerate the body. In 1956, three groups showed by experiment that they could transplant bone marrow from one mouse into another mouse that had had that lethal dose of irradiation. And the chromosomal markers that were specific for the donor were in the cells that regenerated the blood-forming system. That overthrew the paradigm of the day. Before that experiment was done, everybody, who wanted to get a grant anyway, believed that the injected bone marrow cells released radiation repair factors that fixed up the breaks in the DNA. They didn't know it was DNA then. And then the cells were okay. And you're going to hear me say this over and over again, that if you can't get a grant, you're not in the field. And if you had made the wrong choice of what you said at that time, you wouldn't have got a grant. So now we know that the bone marrow is the site of blood production, and it regenerates the system when injected into the bloodstream. In 1961, Till and McCulloch in Toronto did a beautiful experiment. They injected smaller and smaller doses of bone marrow, and they found that the mice at a low dose, let's say 7, 14, 21,000 cells, died. But they died with little bumps on their spleen. Spleen, bone marrow, are blood-forming organs. Spleen usually is in reserve, waiting for the bone marrow to fail, but they're blood-forming organs. Those bumps in the spleen had certain kinds of cells in them, and so they then did, with Becker and Wu, probably the most brilliant experiment in the field, at least to date, to that date. They introduced random changes in the cells that were heritable, called chromosome breaks, before they injected them. And each cell that landed in the spleen and gave rise to this bump of cells all had the same chromosome break, and the next bump had a different one. So for those of us who think about cells, that meant there had to be a cell that could generate all the cells in the bump, that's the bottom there. And then they took a bump and made a cell suspension and injected that into another mouse, and not every time, but often enough, it would give rise to a lot of bumps. So they proposed from that experiment, which was a pretty incomplete experiment, that there must exist in the blood-forming system a stem cell that has the property that Len told you. When it divides, it can give rise to one or two stem cells. It, of course, if it gives rise to two daughter cells, on average in our bodies today, it gives rise to a stem cell and another cell we'll call a short-term stem cell. Now, the long-term stem cell can keep making more of itself. This property is called self-renewal for all of our lives. The next cell down, called the short-term stem cell, can do it for a few weeks. And all the rest of the way down, nobody else can self-renew. Now, this sounds pretty simple, but starting to apply that to the field of regenerative medicine, cancer, eventually embryonic stem cells, the brain, brings in an entirely new approach. And as you'll find, people already in the field are extremely hesitant to change their thinking in a way that they have to think different. So molecular biologists are busy thinking about how important the genes are, and they're not negative people, but if I would send them a paper about stem cells, they'd say, what's the genetic mechanism? And I said, well, let's first see what happens, and then we'll figure out the genetic mechanisms. So I'm going to, if people keep coming, keep applying this field of stem cells, which is simply single cells that can make more stem cells by self-renewal and differentiate to give rise to the cells of that tissue. I'm going to just keep applying that to biological discovery and, I hope, clinical translation. How are we doing? That's perfect.
Okay, sorry, we can't find
them. Yes, so I just love this. I'm at Columbia University. I won't say any more. Okay. So that's the general paradigm of stem cells, no matter what kind of stem cell you're looking at. Now, the second point I'm going to make, I want to make it really early, because this really gets the molecular biologist mad. Stem cells are rare cells. So if I wanted to look at a property like how a normal stem cell goes awry and becomes a leukemia, if it's a blood-forming stem cell, and I'll tell you all about that tomorrow, the first thing my biochemist friends, say like Lee Hood, says, send me 100 million cells. And then I have enough that I can look at the genes, the proteins, the RNA, and so on and so on. And I said, I can get about 5,000. And if I have everybody work all week in my lab, we can get 100,000. But here's the important point. Every step of this theoretical stages are really steps where you turn off some genes and you turn on others. And as Richard Axel used to whisper to me when we'd be at seminars, he'd say, transcription factors, or transcription factors. You remember that? Yes. So anyway, turning on and turning off genes are important. How to know which ones turned on or turned off is really important. But if you need 100 million cells to know, you'll never find out anything about stem cells. They're rare cells. Now, our science is becoming an information science. Once you know what genes are on and off and more about the properties of a single cell, you can delve much deeper into asking questions about it, but you need a lot of help. You need a lot of bioinformatics and statistics help, and I'll show you some of it tomorrow and the next day, that it really becomes extremely important. And so it is an information science, but to find out the information, you have to dig it out of rare cells. So that's all that is. But I'll tell you something. Stem cell biology is leading the push to understand the biochemistry and function of single cells. And once you have methods to think about the biology of single cells, then you can go to other really important cells. Like you might ask, which I will ask speculatively on the last lecture, can a single cell in the brain develop a memory? And if so, how does it do it? Can a single cell in the brain not only develop a memory but express a thought? So these are the kinds of issues that I don't think you're going to get at till you start studying the biochemistry of the cells at the single cell level. But this is, I'll get to that later. You can barely see this. This is simply to say that after an egg is fertilized, and the egg, as I'll tell you in the third lecture, is coming down the fallopian tube from the ovary. It got fertilized up there. It's got about 4 days to divide and make enough cells to make that intermediate thing called the blastocyst, which implants in the uterus. And then and only then, according to the medical dictionaries, and in fact, a lot of developmental biologists, it's called an embryo. An embryo begins with the formation of the three germ layers that will eventually make the tissues. Now, the reason I'm emphasizing that is that on the third lecture, you will see how the politics of our country and religion, or organized religions, have taken mistaken semantics of what an embryo is and what it isn't to, in fact, ban whole areas of research in this country. So it's important at least to know what the people were doing when they thought about it. Now, once it implants in the uterus, it makes those, you can see them, three layers. And the three layers will give rise to stem cells for each of the tissues. And those stem cells will make blood. Other ones will make muscle, pigment, brain cells, and so on. And so that's, we want to be able to regenerate anything, any organ in our body that's gone off, if we could. And we want to do it with the cells that are the result of hundreds of years of evolution. Very complex systems give you stem cells and regulate their numbers and what they do. Now, I will also say in the third lecture, from that pre-implantation, pre-embryo blastocyst, the cells that are just in the middle, the 15 to 20 cells, can be cultured in a dish. And that's what's called the misnomer embryonic stem cells. The value of those cells is they, like the cells inside the blastocyst, can give rise to all cell types of the body. And that's why there's so much at stake to try to understand these embryonic stem cells and ones that come from individual people with individual genetics, including the genetics of their particular disease. For us to get a full understanding of how diseases come about, it would be an important new tool to have stem cells that can recapitulate the disease. So I'll talk about adult tissue stem cells. Tomorrow, cancer stem cells. The third day, about embryonic and pluripotent cells. And the fourth day, I'll talk about the co-evolution of cells, of the stem cell series in the immune system, and some of the consequences of the patterns of migration stem cell take for understanding some issues. And then I'll be wildly speculative, and maybe only one person in the room will think I'm not crazy. We'll see. Okay. So this is just taking that first picture and applying it to the blood-forming system. So that's an actual picture of the first isolated mouse blood-forming stem cell, and it makes all those kinds of blood. So the question would be, if you said prospectively, I know by that chromosome marker experiment that there should be stem cells, how do you actually get them in your hand so you can understand what they do? And also so that you can use them to treat a disease? Well, first I have to tell you, bone marrow is the place in adult life that we have stem cells. When you're born, you have blood-forming stem cells and other tissue stem cells called mesenchymal stem cells in the umbilical cord. The way that those cells got from the tissue into the umbilical cord is now used by doctors to mobilize stem cells into the blood. So now I'm just going to go through the general thing that we use. I don't expect anybody here except scientists in the field to know what this is about. But we had to have a way to get pure stem cells at the end. Who's heard about monoclonal antibodies? Okay, a fair number. So a great discovery was made about 30 years ago that each cell that can make antibody has genetically the ability only to make one antibody, that can only make an antibody of one shape, that can only recognize one shape in the universe. And when you clone the cell that makes the antibody and make it make a lot of antibody, then you have gallons of that particular antibody. You can color the antibody green, blue, or red by a chemical reaction. You can have a microscope that lets you see whether it was green, blue, or red, the antibody, or the cell it attaches to. And if you can see it by eye, somebody will invent a machine that sees it. And the Herzenbergs at Stanford invented a machine that can see up to 40,000 cells per second. And on the basis of the color they have attached to their surface, sort them into one versus another test tube. I won't go into any more of the details except to say the machine exists. It can look at more than one color at a time. So you can say, sort me red, green, and yellow, but not blue. And it will sort that in. If each different antibody you're using has a different color, then you can reproducibly find the cells that have the shape on their surface that that antibody binds to or doesn't. In mice, we found those are the molecules that are on the stem cell, the blood-forming stem cell surface, and this whole set of names are ones that aren't. It's not really important, obviously, to know that information, but it is important to know that 1 in 15,000 cells in the mouse bone marrow are these long-term stem cells. Without them, you wouldn't make blood. When we, in 1988, transplanted those cells, and back then we were at 1 in 2,000, not 1 in 15,000, we could save lethally irradiated mice with those cells. Now, in that Toronto McTillan-McCulloch experiment, I told you if they gave 7,000 cells, they could get a bump. 14, you get two bumps, 21,000, three bumps. It takes 200,000 bone marrow cells, unfractionated, to save a mouse from irradiation. And you can multiply by the weight of a mouse how much you would need to save a human from a nuclear accident. That's there. So this is 10, 100, 1,000 cells. Doesn't save any mouse. At 200,000 cells, you just save 90% of the animal. Back then, we had 1 in 2,000 cells, and they were 2,000-fold enriched in the ability to save the animal. Now, I won't go through all the assays we had before we tried to transplant them, just to say, when we got to this experiment, we knew it was more than just science we were looking at. It was something that had a practical chance also to regenerate the blood-forming system. So we wanted to be able to do human transplants. And as you might imagine, if we had put up an ad at Stanford for medical students to sign up to be volunteers to be irradiated so that we could test out our notions of stem cells, you wouldn't get many takers. Luckily, Mike McCune and I found that we could transplant human fetal organs into mice that genetically had no immune system but could stay alive within a bubble-like atmosphere. Like the patients with severe combined immunodeficiency, the mice can't make an immune response. So here, if you put human fetal thymus under the kidney capsule, we put several, they grow fine. Over there, if you put a human femur or the femur rudiment that's going to grow, it grows fine and it opens up its cavity and it takes in bone marrow cells, usually mouse. But if you irradiate this mouse instead of a medical student and transplant bone marrow in, you can narrow down the cells that will regenerate all of the blood cells, which we did. Now, we did that at a company called Systemics, and I could go into it now or later, all of the issues, good and bad, about trying to form a company, trying to shepherd it through to do the right and not the wrong experiments. What happens when it gets so attractive, the big boys buy it, and how fast that they can ruin it by simply not having the people with the vision of what it can do there, but managers. And I can say that in many different ways, and anytime you want to raise your hand, I'll tell you more. But I'll just say the work was done at the company Systemics, and it's got a history to it that I'm not going to go into now. So now we could actually isolate human blood-forming stem cells, and no matter which patient, no matter what stage of their development, no matter what tissue we got it from, it was always the same set of markers that I showed here, which are very similar, by the way, to the mouse markers. So at the end of the day, we could get pure hematopoietic stem cells by cell sorting. Now we can start thinking about why we might want to have human hematopoietic stem cells rather than the bone marrow or mobilized blood that are the meat of transplantation today. So here we have bone marrow or mobilized blood, and I showed that they have cancer cells in it. When a woman gets to the stage 4 of breast cancer, 40% of the time she has so many cancer cells in her bone marrow and blood that if you transplant her cells back into her after you try to kill the cancer cells, you find that those cancer cells will engraft. God, I thought she was leaving. See, take the example, move closer. So we can get stem cells pure. And when I say pure, I mean pure. And we could since 1992. And so we could transplant those cells. Now, if Len had a disease where he needed a transplant, but his stem cells were lousy, and he needed, let's say I'm his brother, my bone marrow or my mobilized blood, I've already developed cells in my body called T cells that would reject a skin graft from Len to me in my body, and they'll reject his skin in his body too. And they'll reject his heart and his liver, his mucosa, his lung. And that's called graft versus host disease. And you have to treat it. If he and I weren't what's called HLA matched SIBs, there's no way you could treat it. It's so intense, even the best immunosuppressive drugs barely slow it down. So if you need that kind of a transplant today, yes, I'll just say, the only way you would avoid that graft versus host disease is get rid of the T cells that were already there. And I'll get back to that. Okay, so we did 3 clinical trials. We took patients with a cancer that had spread. 3 patient groups. One, stage 4 breast cancer. The second one, the kind of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that wasn't susceptible to the treatment of the early or mid-90s. Couldn't treat it successfully. You know, mantle cell and large cell. And multiple myeloma, which is a tumor that grows in the bone marrow. So in all of them, you had gross contamination. And our idea, which was the same idea as the oncologist, is you take the cells out, purify them, and freeze them down. Now you treat the patient not with a sublethal dose of combination chemotherapy, but a supralethal, a dose that you're aiming to kill every cancer cell in the body. And I should say that killing cancer cells in the body by increasing the dose is a very well-studied phenomenon. The more of a particular drug you give, the more cells you kill, until you kill down to a cell that was already resistant. That's about 1 in 1,000,000 for any single drug. The same cell won't be resistant to another drug already. So if you give two drugs with a dose that kills it down, then it's 1 in 1,000,000 times 1 in 1,000,000, roughly. And so on and so on. So the idea is to give combinations of drugs that would kill the cancer cells, clean up the patient, and save them with their own bone marrow or mobilized blood or purified stem cells. The idea there now is to regenerate the system and give it a clean start by not reintroducing cancer cells in it. So this was done at Stanford, and these were some of the things that we looked at. These were the patients, and I should say quickly, because I was co-founder of the company, and because I had stock and consulting fees for the company, I, of course, couldn't be in charge of or seeing patients in the clinical trial. But I'm like Richard Axel. I got an MD, and nobody would even want me to see a cancer patient. This small change. So we wanted to know, was it going to work ahead of time? And we could do it, because we could take authentic breast cancer cells or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or multiple myeloma. We could mix it together with somebody's mobilized peripheral blood, which we did. And then we could take it to the sorter and ask, did we get rid of the cancer cells that were human, authentic cancer cells, in the human's mobilized peripheral blood? And we got a 245,000-fold depletion of breast cancer, 220,000-fold depletion of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, 150,000-fold depletion of myeloma. This was adequate that no patient of ours had a detectable cancer cell in the transplant. Same for the lymphoma. It was very hard to get that achieved with the myeloma because the contamination was so massive. So post-sort, 0% positive, cancer-positive cells in the breast cancer. These were stage 4. So I should say, stage 4 means the cancer spread. It's gone beyond the breast, beyond the lymph node, somewhere in the body, and it's macroscopic, meaning it's big, and you can see it in a bone, in the liver, or the lung. If you saw it in the brain, we had to exclude the patients because the drugs we gave, or they gave, didn't cross the blood-brain barrier adequately. So now this is real clinical data, and I'll just take you through it so you understand, because it's important for the argument. This is increasing the dose of purified stem cells we gave back to the patient. This is how many days it took to get enough white cells not to get infected, or enough platelets that you wouldn't bleed out when you bumped into some. And what you can see is, at the very lowest dose, we had some prolongation in time to get platelets, hardly any prolongation to get white cells. And then you went 100-fold up, because there was one patient who had massive numbers of cells. And the thing you can see is that it hardly got better. It got better. So that was probably 9 days to 10 days. That's 10 to 13. That's average 13. But both of these, when we got the data, converted this to an outpatient trial. because they got back their infection-fighting white cells so fast, it was more dangerous to be in a hospital that has antibiotic-resistant bacteria than to be in a hospice setting where you're not concentrating this. All of the patients engrafted. Here's for the first 4 years of the study until Novartis bought the company. So I got to say, for those who are clinical trialists, this is what's called a phase 1-2 trial. This didn't have a comparative arm where you gave the standard treatment. I'll talk about the comparison, but this was the early phase. Well, for women with stage 4 breast cancer, at 2 years, 45% alive without disease. It looks like about 75% overall survival. At 4 years, when the people were still looking carefully, it was 37% alive without disease and about 50% survival. Now at 8.5 years average, it's 16% alive without disease, and we haven't checked why they died in between. That little X is this study done at the same time by Stadtmauer in Pennsylvania, where they gave back everything, the mobilized peripheral blood. They gave very similar combination chemotherapy, but remember they didn't purify the cancer cells away from the stem cells. And their progression-free survival was 6% at 2 years, and we had 45%. So, I think this is reasonable to ask these questions. What happened after we finished the trial? And where can you go for a transplant? I'll answer this first. Nowhere. There's no company that picked it up. No company that, even Novartis that bought us, that wanted to invest in another trial that would take 3 to 5 years before they knew if they could make a lot of money. Also, this is a service. You isolate the stem cells for the patient. So I'll just say, until the passage of Proposition 71 to fund clinical trials in California, there's no takers for this. I'll add that at least two of the people who were in a position not to recommend it, that is to recommend against making the investment, came to me later when their wife had breast cancer and asked me where the therapy was. So this is a very important example, I believe, for all of us to think about in a country where we don't have universal health care delivery, where we actually don't do great clinical trials because so many people can't be covered for the clinical trial because they don't have insurance, and so on and so on. But I want to extend this just for a second. We did this where we needed to regenerate the blood-forming system because that was the drug we gave. If you had had colorectal cancer or primary liver cancer, at a particular stage of the disease, you know that the liver still has it. Colorectal spreads to the liver first and then beyond. And there are therapies that try to kill the cells in the liver, but they all have to stop when they kill too many liver cells. If we had liver stem cells, we could test whether we could do therapies for those sets of diseases where liver metastasis or transplantation or our tumor is present. Okay. Now, I've spent a long time here just talking about what blood-forming stem cells are and what happens if you give them back to yourself. Now I'm going to talk about Len again. So this is Len. He needs a transplant. That's me. My T cells will make that immune reaction against every tissue in his body. So obviously when we first did this, we wanted to know if pure stem cells free of T cells would give the graft versus host disease. And we showed in mouse and then in human to skid hue, human organs, that they didn't. There's no dose of stem cells that would give rise to that. Now, I just have to explain that for a minute to the non-immunologists. Blood-forming stem cells, when they go to the organ that makes T cells, first turn on the set of genes that would make their immune receptors to be able to detect infection or foreign cells. There's a process within the thymus that many of us spend our life on, which deletes those cells that would react against your own tissues, but still allows the cells to get out that would fight an infection of your tissues. So if you reacted against your own tissue, you would have what's called an autoimmune disease. You would be immune to yourself. And many people here treat the mistakes that happen in certain human diseases. When we put stem cells from a donor into a host, and they make new T cells in the thymus, they delete not only the cells that would have reacted against the host brain, the host pancreas, the host skin, the host liver and lung, the heart, but also that would react against their own tissues. It's a complicated issue, but it's true. So that means that you have no graft versus host disease, and at the bottom, you are permanently tolerant to tissues from the donor. So we tested that in animals first, of course, where we took a mouse that was genetically different from another mouse. We regenerated this mouse's blood-forming system with the donor blood-forming stem cells, and we put a heart transplant. We put them in the ear so we could follow by the EKG, the electrocardiogram, how long the heart's alive, the same day or a year later, and it doesn't matter, so long as it came from the same stem cell donor genetically, it was accepted permanently. And we even reduced the amount of radiation to get it in so that no animal was at risk during this time. Because the stem cells self-renew and regenerate the system over and over again, it's a single transplant to induce permanent transplantation tolerance. So if we could work out a safe way to take donor blood-forming stem cells and get them to engraft in a host, it would be a one-time treatment for their disease. You would avoid graft versus host disease because there's no T cells that you put in. As I said, something can happen so that you have a mistake that makes you react against yourself. And then you have immune T cells or immune antibody forming cells that react against self. It turns out most or all of those diseases are at least the predilection are inherited from the parents. It's not usually a single gene. It's many different genes. So if you've got one of those diseases, you got the unlucky throw of your parents' genetic dice. You got the combination of genes that allowed the disease to come out. Now, usually these diseases are known by very strange names, like systemic lupus erythematosus or rheumatoid arthritis. But there's other diseases that it wasn't suspected for a long time that are also simply autoimmune diseases. The first one I want to tell you about is childhood diabetes. It's called type 1, used to be called juvenile diabetes. In virtually all of the classical type 1 diabetes, the patients have inherited the genetics that allows them eventually to make an immune response against their own insulin-producing cells. It is not a disease of insulin-producing cells. It's not the lifespan of an insulin-producing cell is shortened. It is an immune response, inflammatory and killing, that gets rid of those cells. It can be reproduced in animals and has been reproduced in animals. Judy Shizuru and I looked at the animal model. Now, somebody's going to say afterwards, anybody can cure the mouse disease, and I'll say, maybe. But here we have 100% of the animals, 0% of the animals, and now we're looking at animals free of the disease. And pretty soon it drops down to zero for male and female mice in our mouse colony. Right there. Now we're going to irradiate these animals and transplant them. First we're going to give them their own whole bone marrow to see whether the irradiation or the conditioning would by itself wipe out the disease. And you bought about a month. About a month out of 2 years to 3 years lifespan is a lot. This is the experiment that's being done at Northwestern by Richard Burt. Actually, he's doing it in South America. Well, since it's an autoimmune disease, if you gave pure stem cells and not the contaminating autoimmune T cells, you ought to do better with stem cells from the donor, I mean from the host, the patient. And you gain another couple months. But inevitably, the disease comes back. So whatever triggered the autoimmune response, we'll do it even with freshly developing T cells. But now what if we take it from a donor that genetically is resistant to getting type 1 diabetes? I hate to say how long ago we published this, 12 years. It prevents progression of the disease forever in the mice. It prevents it because the donor cells are stem cells that self-renew and they keep making the immune system that's resistant to the disease. And the first time we did it with a bizarre combination of donor and host. And then we could, Judy and I, limit it to what would be in every family, a parent or a sibling. So these mice are related to the host that they match at the important locus that would block or cause immune rejection. So they have minor differences between them that would still cause immune rejection, but would take a long time. These mice have three diabetes resistance genes where the host has diabetes susceptible genes. And it cures them. And if we even give them just a half copy, the maternal copy, let's say, of the three disease-resistant genes, it cures them. So we can take a diabetic mouse at the moment it starts to drink too much and pee too much, or before that, if we knew, we can cure them every time. We can cure them by conditioning them sublethally, and by having a matched graft, it's trivial to get a dose that rapidly engrafts. They're outpatient treatments. So if we could do the same in humans, we would probably destroy the insulin industry. Not that's how I'm thinking about it, but Harvey, you're going to have to tell me what selling short means again. Okay. What if you're already diabetic? Well, there we found that no matter what stage the animal's disease, if they've already destroyed their insulin-producing cells, we can use blood-forming stem cells from that donor that's resistant and create resistance in the host and then transplant islets, the insulin-producing cells from the donor, and that cures them at any stage. So that says this disease has at least two stages that we can address. One, a developed autoimmune disease that kills the cells, and two, replacement of the cells that were killed. At any time in the disease, if you do one, you're able to transplant the cells, which are two. In a famous trial called the Edmonton trial, they transplant the islets only. They don't get rid of the autoimmune disease, and those patients are on immunosuppressive drugs, and they lose the transplant eventually. So this could change the this particular disease. This is regenerative medicine. If we can work out the simplest and safest way to do it. And if we had a source for islets. And I'll just say once again, Bruno Payot has sent this slide to me, that he's able to take human fetal pancreas. And in those immunodeficient mice, he can grow it up, and it makes insulin enough to save a mouse that has a drug-induced diabetes. So we have a way of finding pancreatic precursors. That is, we have an assay. Twice the grant was rejected by the NIH. And on the study section, I'll just have to tell you, were people whose names none of us knew. It's not the same as when we were all in the study section before. And that's really what a public group should talk about sometime. Because peer review is the best way to review a grant so long as the peers know what they're talking about. It's no longer that for most study sections that give grants. I know I'm showing a little bias, but it's true. I'm going to talk for another 15 minutes and then we'll have a discussion. But I wanted to get that part there. That strange disease, lupus, I told you about, is an autoimmune disease. You make antibodies against your own DNA, RNA, and proteins. When the antibody and, say, the DNA get together in the bloodstream, they get filtered out in the kidney, and they cause inflammation that damages the kidney badly, and then the kidney doesn't work as a filter anymore, and the proteins that are in the blood go into the urine, and you can measure the severity of the disease. At a company I co-founded called Celerant, we found that we could transplant, this is called a haplotransplant, stem cells from a disease-resistant donor. A haplotransplant is the parent of any child. That's the best way to think of it. And this is when they die of the disease, the mice. This is when they get the conditioning only. This is if they get the allogeneic stem cell transplant from a donor that is resistant to the disease. Sorry about that. All right. Sorry about that. And this is severe protein levels in the urine for the few people who treat this. This is the mice that are age-matched control. This is the pure allogeneic stem cell, the frequency. It is a cure for that disease at any stage. So I would say up to this time, these are the names of the autoimmune diseases that have a genetic component to them and ones that I believe regenerative medicine can approach. Now I'm going to take you on a slight journey, and then this will have a lot of significance later, but it's kind of an interesting journey. When we could get blood-forming stem cells in the bone marrow in our hands, we knew they could self-renew to make more stem cells. We knew they could differentiate to make those short-term stem cells that self-renew just for a few weeks. We now know that with a surprisingly high frequency, they die. And they die an apoptotic death. That's for a few. A self-killing death. So knowing this, and knowing that there are niches for the bone marrow stem cells to survive in. If that's happening in my body, by my age, I probably wouldn't be able to make blood anymore if I didn't have a way to replace the niche with a new and good stem cell. So when we looked carefully, Amy Wager's, Doug Wright and I, we found that in the blood of a mouse, they have 10 long-term stem cells and 90 multipotent progenitors, or short-term stem cells. If we infuse them back into the bloodstream of a mouse, they disappear from the bloodstream within a minute, 90% of them, 100% by 5 minutes. Then we label them and put them in and ask where they go. They go to the blood-forming organs. bone marrow, spleen, and liver. They know how to home once they're in the bloodstream. So these are cells that are stem cells in the bloodstream, and explains something that had puzzled me forever. Why do bone marrow transplants work? You take a cell from an organ and you put it in the bloodstream, and it knows how to go back to the organ. I assure you that if you put brain stem cells in the blood, they don't know how to get to the brain. If you put skin stem cells in, they don't know how to get to the skin. But bone marrow stem cells know how to get back to the bone. And we've discovered the molecules that do it. I'll just say there are molecules. But the interesting thing is, if they have to replace, they have each mouse 100 of those cells at any moment, and every 5 minutes you have to replace it, you have to have a new bunch come out of the bone marrow into the blood to replace them. And that means you have to replace them at a rate of about 30,000 cells per day for a mouse, 10% of which are stem cells, 90% of which are those multipotent progenitors. So they are recirculating cells. Bone marrow to blood, bone marrow, wait a while, blood, back to bone marrow, wait a while. They're ostensibly filling the empty niches that happen from cell death or an accident. Because remember, our ancestors didn't live in the first world, but ate fungi and other things that carried toxins that could kill cells in the body easily. Okay, so that's the teleology. We found that those cells normally can go from one mouse to another. I'm only putting this up because a lot of people will object to it. We make artificial Siamese twins of mice that are genetically distinct. And we find that when they form a cross-circulation, the only thing that circulates between them is blood, that 5% of the blood-forming stem cells of another animal comes from the first. So that recirculation is effective at getting cells in. If we look how long, I said it takes a short time, if we put in a single cell that has a label that you can look at by imaging externally, this one landed in the skull on day 12. 2 weeks later, its daughter stem cells had set up foci throughout the body. Now, tomorrow, I'm going to talk about leukemias of this system. So it's no surprise that when you get a leukemia called a myelogenous leukemia, any of the myelogenous leukemias, even though we know for sure it started from a single cell, you can stick a needle into any bone cavity in the body, and the leukemia will be there. It's the property of recirculation with specific homing, and they use the same molecules that the normal stem cells use to find that home. So they go out. Now, we wanted to test whether we would be able to treat severe combined immunodeficiency. And what we found was that stem cells came back and they filled the empty space that genetic deficiency had. And this is just experimentally that it does it in unirradiated mice that are immunodeficient. So we didn't clear a niche, we just counted on the number of cells going out and coming back, leaving an empty niche. And if you repeat it the next day, you get another 0.5% of the cells coming from it. And here's the ultimate test. This will be a clinical trial. If we give 12,700 stem cells to a mouse that's immunodeficient, can't reject them, we get about 0.75% of all the cells, stem cells in the bone marrow, come from the donor. If we give a single dose. But if we wait, we do 1/7 of it every day for 7 days in a row, we have almost fivefold the engraftment. And so there's a consortium of people who treat this rare genetic disease, and we're going to try multiple pure stem cell transplants with them. But for the future, we would like to be able to treat people who don't have cancer with stem cells. So I've given you the examples: autoimmune disease, tissue transplantation, genetic deficiencies of the blood. I just gave you one, severe combined immunodeficiency. But there's sickle cell anemia, curable by transplant, if you can get it in safely and early enough. Giving them graft-versus-host disease is just about as bad as them having, the patients having sickle cell disease. There also is Mediterranean anemia and its variants around the world. This is a huge burden. So we need to have a way that we don't irradiate the host. Irradiation is simply historical. Chemotherapy is historical because the oncologists, the cancer doctors, are the ones who started using bone marrow transplant. So now we want a way to prepare the host as if they were coming into the office. You'd give them a treatment. Next day you're going to give them stem cells, or a week later. So here's a paper that Anishka Chekovitz, who was an undergraduate and then a medical student in the lab, and Deepta Bhattacharya did. We looked through all the antibodies we or other people had made that saw mouse stem cells. And then we asked, which of them will deplete mouse stem cells from the bone marrow? And this one did. Our friend Shinichi Nishikawa made that. So if you give stem cells to a mouse without irradiation, without the antibodies, you can expect to get 1% donor-derived cells. But if you pre-treat once with the antibody, you get 15%. If you give stem cells, give it again, give stem cells, give it again, three outpatient treatments, now you have 95% donor-derived cells. Now, we did these in mice that wouldn't have an immune rejection. But we know, Judy Shizuru and I, that if we have antibodies against the immune cells that are depleting, we can also accomplish the transplant. So we are going to do first severe combined immunodeficiency, and the most important 2 points will be that they engraft, that we give enough cells that engraft, and they don't cause graft-versus-host disease. And third, of course, is that they cure the immunodeficiency. That will be a worldwide consortium that's just being built up by Mort Cowan from the University of San Francisco. Now, all of this time, I've talked about blood-forming stem cells. And in the 10 minutes or so that I have to talk, I want to go to a couple other stem cells and show you a big mistake that happened in the field. This is the result of the mistake. Many prominent investigators who weren't stem cell biologists transplanted bone marrow into mice that had their skeletal muscle damaged one way or another. And they claimed that the bone marrow turned into muscle and repaired the muscle. When we tried to repeat the experiments and we used good markers, not bone marrow and not even hematopoietic stem cells could regenerate the muscle, but we found 0.04% of the cells had markers of the donor and of the host, that cells fuse in the muscle. Now, in fact, the way muscle's made is cells that are called muscle stem cells start dividing, and then they all fuse together to make a myofiber, a muscle fiber. And I think that's what they were seeing, was inapparent fusion without fixing. So again, Amy Wagers and another undergraduate, Richard Sherwood, and I simply started fractionating mouse muscle, and we found a rare cell that gives robust transplantation. And God, the markers don't show unless I change the color. God, sorry about that. You have to trust me because we published it. We found that this is a subset of the cells that are called satellite cells that regenerate the muscle. And Amy has now shown that these cells put into muscular dystrophy muscles cure the disease. Bone marrow cells don't. The daughter cells of these, called myoblasts, don't, because they don't self-renew. So we now have, if we had really aggressive, agile surgeons, the ability to regenerate the muscle if we can get transplants to succeed. The last point I'll make, and it's an important and I do want to make it before we're done, is brain stem cells. Now, the brain develops over a long interval in fetal life, and it stays regenerating in adult life. Obviously, the brain of a newborn and the brain of, say, Len, are different sizes, and something accounts for that size. Many years ago, two groups, Weiss and Reynolds in Calgary, Rusty Gage, then at UCSD, Ron McKay, and others, found that there are ways to culture fetal mouse and fetal rat brains, and you can get from those cultures single cells that, at least in a test tube, can make all the brain cell types by their official names, not tested extensively. So there are neurons, there are astrocytes, and there are oligodendrocytes. Astrocytes are supposed to have a whole number of functions. Neurons are the ones that connect and transmit impulses and are responsible, we think, for most things in the brain. Oligodendrocytes insulate the long nerve fiber called an axon so that you can get a quick electrical impulse. So, at another company called Stem Cells Inc. that we co-founded, Rusty Gage and I, and David Anderson, we undertook to isolate from human fetal brain cells that, under a culture condition, could form a clone that grows as a sphere, and that each clone could make neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes. So this is one of the experiments we published 8 years ago, that if you fractionate all of the human fetal brain cells, that's what this plot is, only a subset of them, called CD133-high, can make those spheres of cells from a single cell. And if you then divide those into ones that have CD24 on versus those that have CD24 off, you can get down to one cell in four will form a neurosphere. Each of those neurospheres in vitro, under the right conditions, that's in a test tube or a plate, can make neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes. Now, at the age that we were able to obtain these fetal human brain cells, many developmental events had already occurred, and our cells don't normally have the chance to go back during development to make the cells that were made earlier. But, of course, we thought about transplanting these cells into the brains of immunodeficient mice. Nobuko Uchida, who was the person who did most of the work, transplanted human neurospheres derived from single human neural stem cells into the brain of these same immunodeficient mice. She did it in newborn mice. Now, I know somebody will correct me, but I'll go ahead as if I'm a neurobiologist. This is a mouse brain. This part receives impulses from the nasal mucosa of odorant receptor-bearing cells discovered by Richard Axel and Linda Bach. The brain makes new cells every day throughout a mouse's life next to this fluid-filled space called a ventricle. And the cells migrate, Arturo Alvarez Buia showed that, to here, where they interact with cells somehow that are bringing in the odorant receptor signals. And it could be argued that they have to turn over here because cells in the nasal mucosa are open to air infection, and they are turning over as well. It's an argument at this point. In the hippocampus of the brain throughout life, there's one part, a tooth-like region called the dentate gyrus, that also makes new brain cells throughout life. And from those cells, they make neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes, but they're not going here. They're sending out processes to another part of the hippocampus, mainly the CA3 region. And Rusty Gage and Gerd Kemmerman showed that the rate of proliferation of those cells can be increased if the mice are undergoing task solving or on a running wheel. But mice that are looking at the mice that are doing the task solving are not increasing the rate. So you can draw your own conclusion whether it's better to watch the NBA or go play basketball. But that's a good correlation. And I'm going to really go after that on the last day. But I'm going to say also in the cerebellum that makes cells that regulate coordination and balance. At birth, they're making lots of cells that they won't make 2 weeks later. The human cells transplanted here into the lateral ventricle of the brain in graft. And now we're looking 47 days later after a single injection of human cells. This is the olfactory bulb. This is the granular layer. The blue is the mouse cells. The dark brown are the human cells. And in general, the orientation of their axons and dendrites, the size and appearance of the cells looks like the mouse. We still haven't seen if they're synaptically connected with the olfactory glomeruli and odorant perception. That's a sad side story. Larry Katz was going to do it with me at Stanford, but he died of a melanoma. The astrocytes are made in the site-appropriate place, oligodendrocytes, site-appropriate. The cells actually see the external layer of the cerebellum and they go in, and some of the cells at least are internal granular layer neurons. And you can even find an occasional neuron of a type that's lost somewhere else in Parkinson's. Now if you look closely, that same mouse 47 weeks later, and you have a Stanford human that's red from the nucleus, you can see 47 weeks after a single deposition of cells, they're migrating still, and lots of them, through this stream that Arturo Alvarez Buia showed. And when we put in a human tumor of astrocytes, the tumor forms the tunnel through which these cells migrate. It's absolutely beautiful. And if you look back here, or, by the way, in the dentate gyrus, the human cells, 47 weeks, are still dividing, whereas they aren't dividing where they differentiate. So, remarkably, given how long we're supposed to be separated from mice, the human neural stem cells are responding largely in a site-appropriate manner. They're self-renewing, they're migrating, differentiating. So already, we have something that no neurobiologist has, another tool. The cells grow as a cell line. We can genetically modify them. And if I were starting another career, I can assure you, this is all I'd work on. Because now you have a different tool to start looking at the function of human cells, human neural stem cells and their daughter cells. But you can already try to treat diseases where you don't have to have precise neuronal connections in a neurodegenerative disease. I'm going to show you two. There's one perfectly awful disease called Batten disease. This is yet another genetic disease where the patients are born without an enzyme whose function is to take apart molecules called lipoproteins. So there's a protein and there's a covalent bond going off to the side or the end that has a lipid. See, this is that Alzheimer's moment. What's the lipid? Okay. What? Yeah, there's a lipid that starts with another name. That it'll come to me sooner or later. But anyway, palmitoylation. Sorry. So anyway, they can't break down lipoprotein that's old in the cells of the brain or the body. They build up aggregates of it, large amounts of it, in the place that breaks it down, called the lysosome. A machine that breaks down proteins and carbohydrates and lipids and reuses the products for the cell to make new proteins, lipids, and so on. They can't do it. Sooner or later, those deposits are big enough, they break open the lysosome, and the contents of the lysosome, when it leaks into the cytoplasm, cause the cells to die. So that's mechanism. But here's fact, they're born perfectly healthy. They look just fine. In America, the variant we have here, they can go, 2, 3, 4 years before you notice that they're going blind or they're ataxic because their cerebellum is losing it or they start losing IQ, probably because of the hippocampus, almost certainly. And they all go into a coma and they all die. In Finland, it starts at a year and it's over by 3. It's a more penetrant form. The enzyme that's made by one cell can be secreted with a sugar tag on it that allows another cell, here it's the same cell, to recognize it, bring it in, and take it to the lysosome. So this is a lysosomal storage disease. And in general, if you can provide the enzyme in the right form to every cell in the body, you can cure or slow down the progression of the disease. Genzyme has made a business entirely of that, or at least it used to be entirely of that. We tested human brain stem cells across a filter from patient fibroblasts. And they took up the enzyme made by the human brain stem cells. But if we put in the sugar at high concentration, that is the recognition unit, it couldn't be taken out. So then we obtained a mouse that had the same gene mutant. We crossed it to immunodeficient mice. If you now look at that hippocampus, for example, compared to the one on the right, there's hardly any cells. 8% of the normal number of cells. This happens to be the CA3 to CA1 region. CA1 is largely depleted. If we put in a single dose of cells at birth,
We protect up to 33% if we put in three times the dose, 57%. And actually, the neurons throughout the cortex, 97% survive. So that was sufficient to say it's time to do a clinical trial. This was done by the company. First place the company went, the bioethicist on the institutional review board said, you can't do that here because we don't want the first human brain cell transplant to be, stem cell transplant, to be in a child. Now, of course, this is a disease that kills children. There's nobody who makes it to adulthood. So I'm just opening this up as one of the many ethical problems I want you to think about. Ooh. I'll just say, the trial has been done in Oregon. 6 patients, 2 near death, because that's how they do it. 2 patients mid-course, and then 2 patients a little earlier course. It was a dose escalation. Nobody died from the transplants. So the toxicity part is safe. They're going to open up the books on their analysis in February, so we'll see if we actually got out of a toxicity trial some efficacy indication. If it works for this lysosomal storage disease that has neurodegeneration as part of it, it should work in the others, and there are plenty of them. So that's neuroprotection. The second one is myelination. When the group at the company, Nobuko Uchida et al., put these cells into a mouse that genetically couldn't make oligodendrocytes that wrap and insulate the neurons, or into other conditions of what's called demyelination, the human cells rapidly and effectively myelinated the mouse. So this is another huge puzzle. The genetic mutation was one in making myelin basic protein, a component of the oligodendrocyte, and the result was, if you don't have myelin basic protein, you can only make 1 or 2 wraps around the axon. You need 18 to 20 to have an effective insulator. The human ones did 18 to 20. Why weren't they competed out by the mutant oligodendrocytes? I have no idea. But this allows you to do a clinical trial. Now, most of you, and certainly me before, were taught that if you have a spinal cord injury, most of which are crush injuries, that you get a complete degeneration of cells and that you lose electrical impulses, let's say, from the head to the muscle, and pain from the skin back up to the head, because the nerves have degenerated. It's called Wallerian degeneration. Yet when we looked at experimental samples and pathological samples of humans, quite often they're demyelinated. Now when you look at what the injury is, it's a crush injury to the spinal cord. It's crushed part of the spinal cord and the blood vessels going there. The blood vessels are delivering nutrients and oxygen. The cells that die are the cells that have their cell bodies in the ischemic region, it's called. And for a long time after that, those are the only cells that are dead. So you don't have to think about putting a cell in the brain that over many years will send its axon correctly to a muscle or a neuron in the skin that will send its axon up to the pain receiving areas. You've got the injury site itself. So Eileen Anderson and Brian Cummings did the crush in immunodeficient mice and later in rats, and they were transplanted just above and just below the injury site within the spinal cord. And it's also been done in monkeys. You can do the injection without causing injury. If you gave the cells the day of the injury, they were killed by the inflammation the injury induces. If you gave them 9 days later, or 30 days later, or even 60 days later, you get this. If you put in non-neuronal cells, and this is a logarithmic scale. Oh, crap. Sorry. Sorry. These are fibroblasts. They make the enzyme, but they don't know how to migrate. They don't know how to turn into other cells. Forget the enzyme. This is human neural stem cells. On this scale, this is walking, this is paralyzed. And this is enough animals now that it's highly significant, same with rats. Here, at the 18-week time point, they're given diphtheria toxin, which at a dose that kills human, but not mouse cells. They demyelinate, and they lose the walking activity. So the human cells are necessary and must be maintained sufficient to treat this disease. And if we're lucky, nah, I can't get this thing to work. No. I'm sorry. One more try. You're going to see the mouse walking. Paralyzed first and active later. I can't get it to work on this computer. Okay. Now, in 2005, Senator Sam Brownback introduced a bill in the Senate to block all formation of human mouse chimeras, especially that could include the brain. Any level. $1 million fine, 10 years in jail. And in 2006, with the State of the Union address, President Bush said, that's the most egregious experiment that biologists can do. So I actually testified before Sam Brownback in his committee, and I showed him this list. I said, okay, you tell me, which of these diseases we shouldn't do experiments to try to find a way to treat the patients? And he couldn't find one. He just said that morally he was against making human-mouse hybrids. Well, we know that when you try to make blood-forming stem cells turn into brain, they don't do it, or skeletal muscle, or cardiac muscle, and vice versa, and so on. And I was going to show you a bunch of slides that says that's so. Still, right now, there's probably about 10,000 to 15,000 patients this year that will get bone marrow cells injected into their heart instead of other therapies. Because one small group with personal interest, partly from Harvard, are reported that bone marrow cells can turn into and regenerate the heart in mice. When we repeated it, it doesn't work. So there's just a whole bunch of things and about how you know something's true. And I'll end with that part, and then we'll have a discussion if people want. This is a new field. It requires a lot of rigor to know what you're doing in this field, the kind of rigor that Gowans taught me about purifying lymphocytes. There are a lot of people with good intentions who want to treat disease, and they see early results, and for whatever reason, they're immediately in the press even before their papers come out. We've been fighting since 2001 the notion that one stem cell can turn into another. It goes against what we know biologically. It goes against the formation of the germ layers. It goes against, I have a whole set of experiments that's going to show. Beautiful experiments. They're gone. There it is. I'll just show you a couple of them, okay? And I won't describe what the experiment is. I just want you to appreciate what it looks like. That's a small intestine. It was grown from a mouse that had four clonal embryonic stem cells of four different colors. And one thing you can see is each color is true. There is no cell fusion. There's no replacement of a few cells here with green or red. What you're seeing is the intestinal villus, the blood vessel and tissue supply of it that's got all four colors. And obviously for this, there was a blue clonal progenitor. I just want to show you because it's so pretty. And it's every tissue of the body. And I'm partly showing this to induce Richard to look at the brain with me. That's the tongue. Now the tongue, in fact, does have cells fusing. So you get a rainbow of colors in the muscle. But the salivary glands are clonal. Okay. So as I said, this is a field that has a lot of people that want to be in it. It's a field that has not ever attracted significant support from either the big pharmaceutical, that is small molecule, or the big protein biotechnology companies. Just like it took years for people to recognize the Genentechs and the Amgens and so on of the world that made proteins and eventually made products out of it. Sooner or later, somebody will start doing this. My own take is that I can't wait forever. So in California, there is Proposition 71, in which the state sells bonds, and you can apply to do clinical trials if you already have a proven stem cell from adult or embryonic sources that leads to robust tissue regeneration. So we'll do that. We'll see if we're competitive. But I'll leave it open now simply to say that you get three more lectures to go. that this is a very interesting field. And the only thing we did for every aspect of everything we've done is to apply the simple principle that stem cells are different than other cells in a tissue because they're the self-renewing cells in a tissue. So I'll leave it there and then open it up for questions. Question?
Do you think that there's a strong chance that the regulatory and administrative environment
for your field will improve under the Obama administration? So the question is whether the Obama administration will change things. I'm sure they'll change things. The people who are advisory to the president on the President's Science Council are people who understand these things. On January 2nd, the transition team had a number of us present data to them, facts about where the field is, where it could go, and also try to clear up the misinformation. I mean, that one about one stem cell turning into another, when I was out on the stump talking for Proposition 71, every place I stopped, people would bring me a leaflet from their priest at the Catholic Church, which said, it's already proven that one adult stem cell can turn into another. You don't need to do embryonic stem cell research. I even met with the Pope once about this. And absolutely adamant for their own religious reasons not to do this type of research. I suspect Obama and his team will do better, and I'll talk about that in the third lecture a lot, because what we really get at with this issue, and that you should all understand, is that when governments bring ideology, whether it's religious or political, or moral ideologies, and impose it on science, science suffers badly. And I'll talk about the historical examples on the third lecture. So the question is, type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset, but as Mark said, actually now is also in children, with the obesity epidemic as well, and especially in Native American populations. It's reaching down into younger and younger people. There is no evidence that it's an autoimmune disease. There's plenty of evidence that it's heritable. So it sounds like a metabolic disease. And the hope is that some understanding will come from it. I've heard of some apocryphal anecdotes that if you have bariatric surgery to close off the amount you can take in or close off part of the upper part of the stomach, that people, even before they lose their gross obesity, convert from type 2 diabetes to normal. And if you read the recent papers by Brown and Goldstein on a molecule called ghrelin, there is at least a precedent for it. But that's all I know. You know, this is the terrific question. And you can ask it of any of the genetic predilection diseases. Lou Gehrig's disease. Why does it wait so long before you start losing motor neurons? Well, something's happening. And the question is it an outside something happening, something about your environment, something about what you eat? They always say that. Never turns out to be. Some chemical you're exposed to, some infection you have. A number of the autoimmune diseases take a long time to develop because you have to break down the regulatory network that holds them in place. Even there, I don't think we have a fundamental understanding of how you break down the regulatory network that holds it in place. But you could ask Len and Harvey and they'll tell you about it. So I don't think that we know why it even takes a child 4, 8, 12 years before they start killing off their islet cells with T cells. I hope you come back tomorrow. It's going to be exciting.